All right, we'll get going. Brett, thank you for joining us this morning. Everyone, please be introduced to Brett Holloway. As is normally the case, we start off with a little introduction. Brett, would you mind sharing with the group how you ended up in healthcare services and what you've been up to?
Sure. Thank you for having me. So my background is maybe a little bit atraditional. I came through investment banking and private equity. So I worked at Evercore Partners, where I was an analyst and associate. Onyx Partners, which is a Toronto-based sort of large-scale LBO private equity fund, where I focused mostly on healthcare services. So we looked back then at a lot of the platforms that were up for sale, things like Concentra, DSI Renal, a lot of ASC platforms, a lot of things in the physicians practice space. And then I moved to Fortress Investment Group, which is actually where Roy and I met, where I helped to stand up a couple businesses, one of which was a outpatient birthing center business called Baby & Co. Tough business for a whole lot of reasons. But very good experience, actually kind of putting on the operator hat a little bit. And then we also stood up a ASC and physician practice business, bought an ASC down in Charlottesville, Virginia, and again, kind of got some real operator experience there. Then got introduced to our founders of the business that I'm at today, which is called Veterinary Emergency Group. Had never looked at the pet space. And when I dug into it a little bit, I really fell in love with the industry. So the space, I'm sure we'll get into this more, but everything that's tough about healthcare, the regulatory landscape, the payer dynamics, all of that just doesn't exist. And so the real downside is that the TAM is just much smaller. So if healthcare is $3.2 trillion or whatever it is today, vet services is probably something on the order of $30 billion, $40 billion, but much less sophisticated and really just a totally different landscape. So the more I dug into that space, I kind of fell in love and then really started to fall in love with the business that I ended up joining as CFO, which is the first platform that's purely focused on emergency services in the pet space. We're probably most analogous to human urgent care in the style of the format of the facilities. The fact that it's kind of more retail focused and more customer focused than it is provider and healthcare focused. And the sort of retail or the site selection and the fact that it's de novo only rather than acquisition based is also pretty analogous to urgent care. So that's been the journey over the last 15 years. Been with Veg now for 4 years, have seen it grow revenue by 40x. And sites from 6 when I joined to 40 today, with another 24 in development this year. 100% de novo. We would do acquisitions if they were unbelievably attractive, but the challenge and the benefit of kind of forging our own path here in the emergency space is there's not a lot of pure play emergency only vet services businesses to acquire. And so that kind of forced our hand into de novo.
So a nice sleepy business.
Yeah. Exactly right.
What an amazing story. So a lot of us on the phone today have watched from the sidelines as the veterinary industry has really gone through transformation over the last 10, 15 years. What's fueling that?
Yeah, so I find the landscape to be fascinating. I have kind of come into the middle, I think, of the first change, and then I think we're right starting the next phase of the change in the growth of the business. So over the last 10 years, private equity has completely saturated the industry with capital. There are, for sort of general context, there's 28 to 30,000 GP, general, so the taxonomy is there's general practice, there's emergency and specialty hospitals, which are very analogous to a human hospital, right? There's an ED, which sort of serves as an entryway into the hospital, but the most of the money and most of the business is really around the specialty part of the business, which is surgeons for things like ACL repair, oncology, ophthalmology. There's some analog essentially in pet care for everything in human care, but from quite a while ago. And part of the reason for that is there's 68,000 small animal vets in the country. There's something on the order of 3,000, I think, that graduate from vet school each year. There's only, I think it's 36 accredited vet schools in the country. They just opened a new one, amazingly, in Texas Tech. That's the first new one in God knows how long. And so there's just not a lot of supply of veterinarians. So there's not a lot of research that's done to sort of move the science along. So it's a pretty small space, historically pretty sleepy. Private equity fell in love with the dynamics. I think that I did, right? Is that there's no revenue cycle, right? I don't even have an AR team at Veg at all. I have three people in AP. Like the sort of back office infrastructure of these businesses is very simple. That made it so you saw a massive level of consolidation. And especially at the beginning of that wave, it was all just bundling. So very little in the way of integration on the back end of the infrastructure. You've got a whole bunch of different practice management softwares that will be sitting inside of a given platform. And a lot of people had a lot of success just aggregating some level of scale, bundling it together, slapping a brand on top of it and selling it without changing anything, right? No change to the surface level brand of any kind. Then maybe over the last 5 years, that's continuing to happen in the background, but the industry is becoming increasingly consolidated. And you've got some of these folks who are pretty gigantic. NVA, which is owned by JAB, which is a big German family office. They're in the process of going public, rumored to be $750 million of EBITDA, 1,200 clinics, something like that, across GP and emergency and specialty. Mars, the candy company, interestingly, has a huge pet arm. I believe actually the pet arm does more revenue than the candy business does today, which is both legacy Mars and then they bought Wrigley at some point in the last, I think during the financial crisis. They own VCA, Blue Pearl, Vet Girl, whole bunch of brands, something on the order of 3,000 clinics. They're actually the biggest. So these guys have aggregated massive scale in this industry. They own maybe 10% of the business, the whole space. And so you got a lot of people who were bundling, selling to them, maybe selling to sort of these bigger platforms. And now you've got maybe five pretty sizable, $100 million plus dollar EBITDA businesses in the space. We are now seeing folks focus much more on integration and operations than they were in the past, as well as on de novo. Because while this whole thing was happening, prices for individual clinics went just crazy, candidly. So it's another reason why we decided to focus on de novo, just consistent being able to, you have a consistent ROIC on your dollars. But some clinics are trading at 20 times pro forma EBITDA. Pretty consistent number would be something in the 12 to 15 times for a single owner operator clinic. The math gets really hard if you're a platform buying it 15 times on average. They're putting equity into every single deal and you're really hoping for a significant multiple ARB because the platforms for a while and still continue to be in the low 20s, but for a while they're in the high 20s. Some were touching the 30s. Corporate EBITDA multiples. And so you got kind of craziness happening. We're now seeing the tail end of that, or sort of like in some ways it's sort of obvious it's going to happen eventually. As interest rates rose, appetite went down, pricing has come down. There's a dislocation between seller and buyer expectations. Deal volume slows down significantly. So if you look at the charts for the number of clinics acquired over the last 3 years, it's fascinating because 2020 started slow. It started fast and then it went really slow as COVID hit. Then it ramped and went really fast. And almost 1,000 clinics got acquired in 2020, which is, you know, 3% of the entire space was consolidated. 2021, it looks like an exponential graph. It starts off pretty fast and it just goes like this to the end of the year of cumulative acquisition targets. And so you ended up with 1,500 clinics being acquired in 2021, which is, you know, 5% of the total GP space. And it's really higher than that, because in reality, the 28,000 GPs that are out there, I don't know what the number is, but some percentage of them are essentially unacquirable, right? Like, individual person hang their shingle is not a business. So you need at least two people in there. In reality, you probably want at least three, so that the person you're buying out, you know, of course, he or she is not going to be super engaged going forward. So the real business opportunity is quite a bit smaller than the 20,000. I've said half, but I just made that number up. But so if you say that, then, you know, 10% of the entire industry was consolidated in a single year. And then last year, it started off even faster than 21, but then like an e-brake got pulled on the whole market. So starting in June, basically the chart flatlines, it kind of looks like a square root graph, whereas the 2021 looks like an exponential. And so you ended the year with another 1,000 total acquired, but you were run rating by the middle of the year last year, like 2,000. So everybody has been acquiring like crazy. Multiples went nuts. People are getting frustrated as platform operators that they knew, they're not stupid, right? They knew that the math doesn't really work here. You're really hoping to create a fool on the sale if you're having to put equity injection into every single acquisition. And they all started to get into de novo development. The challenge there is that it's just a really a fundamentally different business. We've learned that over the last, you know, 4 years, that I didn't have a lawyer on our team until we got a general counsel to actually help with general corporate matters last year. If we had focused on acquisitions, you know, a lawyer would have been probably the next per hire after me. We don't have any of that muscle at all. And these teams have none of the talent development, talent recruiting, actual like physical retail, real estate experience and muscle. So they have, and not to mention like the actual incentivization structure inside of a de novo is pretty different than inside of an acquisition. And it's just it really is just a fundamentally different business. So they're trying to spin these businesses up as they see multiples going crazy. And you do see some level of success. So in 2020, you had like 50, these numbers are all from IDEX, but I actually trust their data collection is pretty good. And we can talk about the diagnostic space and the sort of non-services side if you want, but there was about 50 de novo clinics in the whole country, which is kind of crazy from a corporate. 2021, there's actually fewer, there's like 45. And then 2022, there's like 150. So still a small number in the absolute, but triple the historical recent numbers. And so it's clear that people really were trying to do this and actually getting a few of the clinics stood up. I think we'll see that somewhat continue now. Like the industry in 2023 is going through a very significant paradigm shift, I think. I think you're seeing folks realize that the pure aggregation play is not going to lead to the success that it has in the past. And so if I'm looking for a huge exit, if I bought my platform at 22 times, I'm like, you're really lucky if you're getting multiple ARB on that of any kind. And especially if you're buying clinics at these elevated multiples, it starts to look like a pretty mediocre investment. So you see a lot of folks shifting their focus towards operations, whatever that means, and integration and back-end infrastructure. It's a real challenge in this space, because unlike in the human world where you've got consistent coding for the actual treatments and diagnoses, here it's the Wild West. Even if I have the same practice management software, actual like software suite in two hospitals that I acquire, what sits inside them is a different list of charges. So some of them are going to be reasonably easy to match up one-to-one, but a lot of them are not going to match up one-to-one. And so actually aggregating the data, like it's a challenge for these guys just to get the revenue number to throw out of their systems, right? Whereas for somebody like us, I can get revenue today, literally minute by minute. It simplifies your life a lot to not have that kind of thing. But these folks are saying they're going to do that. You look at that problem, it is a very hairy problem to do back-end systems integrations across, anything north of 10. is a real bear, and at some level you kind of need to rip out and replace. But the customer data inside of those systems for the legacy stuff is the whole business at some level. So they've got a real challenging data piece. And there's a lot of folks who are trying to solve this on the software side of like helping you port over your records from one system to another. And we don't, you know, live in the world of HIPAA or Stark or any regulatory landscape essentially at all, other than under the DEA, which is totally unrelated to the software stuff. And so it's actually pretty doable in theory. In practice, it's still really hard. So I think that the 2023's narrative seems to be take a breath. Let's refocus on making sure you have some level of consistent operations inside the hospitals, some level of consistent SOPs, you know, and that hopefully translates to clinic level margins that are reasonably consistent and growing. You've got slowing overall demand for the service for the first time in 25 years. We're seeing negative year over year comps across the industry, across states. You're seeing, you know, essentially a zeroing out of new clinic acquisitions. So it's a weird landscape for some of these folks who are really saying, I'm going to go full, you know, levered long vet services into just buying clinics and aggregating scale. Last thing I'll say, and then any other stuff. So the while volumes are down pretty consistently for everybody across the board, there's two components of that. One's the demand side, one's actually the supply side. You've had a lot of burnout from veterinarians over the last 3 years. And a lot of what, especially Thrive will tell you, who are there. So NVA and Thrive are both, at least were at the end of this time last year, they both kind of pulled the plug, but they were both looking to go public. Thrive's owned by TSG Consumer, which is a San Francisco-based private equity fund. They will tell you that they're down organically like 8%, but that's all supply side driven. And that being that essentially when I lose a veterinarian out of a clinic, I lost those number of like appointments, right, that I could actually see patients in. And so it's not actually a demand problem, it's a supply problem. Unfortunately, it's kind of both. You are also seeing just organically, you're seeing a reduction of demand for services compared to 2022, which actually saw in some places a reduction in demand versus 2021, which is kind of the high watermark. So that's not an ideal backdrop. Everybody has increased prices a lot. I saw somebody say one of the largest consolidators, I don't know who it is, increased prices 7.5% January 1st. I totally believe it. That number surprised me in the slightest. But everybody seems to be sort of down mid single digits in volume, up mid single digits in revenue, which great, right? We can increase prices. God bless America. Another beautiful thing about this industry, but it also is not a great thing to be relying upon, right? So definitely an interesting time for the vet space.
Really interesting. A lot of facts there. It feels like you're describing a frenzied bubble and the beginning of the aftermath of that bubble. So the further you climb up, the faster you climb up, the more space beneath your feet. You have to look down and wonder the contraction. You know, what does that look like? The restructuring, what does that look like? Some unsustainable expectations there. In the process of all that growth, and all that consolidation and all that acquisition and all those de novos, how do you feel the quality of care has improved, if at all?
That's a really good question. As always, it's very challenging to measure. I think not a lot of innovation has happened on the clinical side of care in a very long time in this industry, as it's been told to me. You will see that diagnostics penetration rates are way up. Usually that is sort of used to say one of two things. One is revenue per visit is up, but also that clinical care is improving.
Sorry, Brent, go ahead.
No, all good. Where was I? So clinical
care improvements.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, again, this industry doesn't have a like recognized set of metrics of like anything related to CMS or anything at all. So there's no, everything you hear will be anecdotal and it'll be case by case, honestly.
So it feels like this business, this market, this industry is stuck in that paradigm of fee-for-service that all of us suffered from for years, where the incentive is purely quantity-driven as opposed to outcome-driven. Do you think that will come at some point, an outcome-based veterinary industry?
We talk about this kind of thing a lot around, insurance, right? The payer dynamics here are what are unique. It's really, in my opinion, it's really a retail business. The only healthcare related thing is the fact that you have to hire these hyper-credentialed folks to actually run the business. Everything else about it is essentially a retail business. The penetration rates for insurance, which is so pets are property for regulatory purposes, right? That's the big regime difference. So because of that, the pet insurance that you hear about is a form of property insurance. Property insurance is, you know, pretty unregulated. There's a lot of things you can do to customize the fees relative to the coverage, and the level of coverage itself is highly customizable. Because of that, I think the consumer view is very muddied, right? Like what you're actually getting when you buy pet insurance is very inconsistent. It can be good probably, and it can be really bad. The total underwriting pool, as I understand it, is about $2 billion a year in premiums and underwritten premiums. That's not big enough to build a business off of, where you could like then invest the float, right? And have it be like, I underwrite at a loss and actually sort of still make money in the business. Putting on my insurance company hat, because of that, it's underwritten at a profit, and anything that's underwritten at a profit is a shitty product for a customer. So I think customers get that at some level, not at that level, but I think they get it at some level. It's expensive care, essentially. It certainly doesn't cover routine visits, right? It's really only for like veg. We kind of like it because it covers what we do, but everybody else, it only covers, you know, if you really have some issue. Given that there's nobody, and so the penetration rates are like, I've heard between 2 and 5%. I think it's higher for new pets. And if you get like a French bulldog, like you kind of should get it. But if you adopt a shelter animal, you probably shouldn't get it, like a mutt. Because of that, you don't have anybody who's going to be forcing the hand of folks. So I think that's a very long, as usual, very long-winded way.
Great answer. Basically, you're saying if you want real results-based outcomes in healthcare, it's helpful to have an organizing body,
for sure, or
organizing class that speaks for otherwise individual users. And where is that in the veterinary space if you don't have a payer industry that's really mature,
right?
And really invested in outcomes.
Yeah, I think that's right. And because there's so few veterinary schools, the academic side of this industry is quite weak as well. So you don't have a ton of research. You don't have anybody who, and that's not true, not anybody, but it's not a huge part of the industry that's, you know, banging the drum and saying that you guys need to implement some form of new, you know, MRI scanning, or here's the overall SOPs for how to take care of yourself. You need to do these scans at this time. Like none of that exists, right? Other than super high level, get your dog's teeth done or whatever. I mean, it's all pretty industry driven. And so it is absolutely in the fee for service price per click, and a rising in a place with seems like price elasticity of demand is extremely high. And so people have been very willing and able to increase prices and pass them through, but we definitely feel like that's, you know, it has to end at some point, right?
No.
And it's increased price. Prices are probably up 100% in the last 10 years.
Yeah, it feels like that has a ticking time, a clock against it, because pets don't live forever. And you are re-educating the consumer marketplace to think of pets as being X times more expensive than they originally considered. So
Yeah.
The financial commitment component changes from one generation of pet ownership to the next, which is probably a 10-year time frame.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Massively so. I mean, we see...
Are you tracking that? Are you tracking new pet adoption rates across the country? Have they gone up, down?
Yeah, so we've got... I again rely on IDEX's data collection on this. They have a really interesting cohorted chart of adoptions versus surrenders. 2022 was below 2019, but higher than any other year. So it's actually really fascinating. The whole narrative of the COVID puppy boom is sort of not true. There were a lot of adoptions, but it wasn't like a step change increase. I think where you saw a step change increase is below the data, which is that we call it the rise of the dinkwad, the dual income, no kids with a dog. The with a dog component is the new piece. So you've got people who's extremely high willingness to pay. This is their only focus. You had a lot of folks who did that, right? And that was a unique thing that they adopted their first or second animal during COVID. But you didn't see actually an absolute rise in adoptions. Absolute adoption rates are actually down.
Yeah.
But that, surrender that, rates are that not dinkwad, up.
That dinkwad class is driving up rents as well.
That's correct. New York City
real estate owning friends in other parts of the world actually who are more than happy to increase rents every year because it's now two earners at home, not one, and there's no kids.
Correct. So
where's all that money going if it's not going to the landlord?
Yeah, right. spoken like a true landlord. But yeah, so it's kind of fascinating. So the adoption rates are stable and surrender rates remain low. So we were a little bit worried that we would see the yield go down where folks kind of boomerang their pet back to the shelter or whatever. Mm-hmm. Glad to see that. You know, human nature hasn't changed. And that's, you know, the sort of percentage of times that happens remains stable.
You know, I wish we all do for different types of news. It's all been, it's almost like a restaurant menu. It's all been condensed down to five items and that's it. And you lose the variety of real information. One of the pieces that I'd love for us as a society to follow much more closely is inflation by market segment.
Yeah.
And it makes for such interesting information. Certain things are inflating at 10% per year and have been for a long time, whereas other markets and consumer products have been inflating at 0%, minus 10%. And it really, those impact all of our lives very meaningfully as employees, as investors, and as consumers. And yet we don't follow it. It would be interesting to look at the veterinary space and ask the question, what has been the rate of inflation there over the past 10 years?
So they do actually have vet services as a component of the CPI. It's currently at, it touched 10% year over year in September, October, and November. It's down slightly to, it was like 9%, nine something in December. Yeah. Similarly, high eights for January. It is absolutely in that space. Now that is an all-time peak for what it's worth, but like it's been consistently, you know, high single digits, above 5% for quite a long time.
It's always a sign, almost like if we were doctors looking at the economy as our patient, it's always a sign that something's not quite right when a market's inflating at 3-4 times the rate of income growth across the country.
Totally. And the thing that's so fascinating about this, right, is because usually I absolutely abhor the segments at which that inflation rate is disconnected from reality, right? So
I'm
a consumer, right? And it's usually because of government intervention, right? So it's healthcare, it's education. This really is because the supply-demand imbalance is just so wonky. There aren't enough veterinarians to provide the service and the demand in the form of number of pets per veterinarian, that ratio has continued to climb and is double what it was in 2000. You've got 90 million dogs, 95 million cats. That's like triple the number of kids. And so you just have this weird supply and demand imbalance in the space. we need a lot more veterinarians to go into school. You know, part of the reason is that they come out of school with, it's like it's expensive to go to med school, but they come out and average 135 to 150K depending upon your market. It's just not enough. Like they're forever in debt at that level, which I think is going to change because there's actually an enormous amount of value that's being captured from them as the corporate consolidator. And I think they will, by sort of nature of the market, continue to capture an increasingly large percentage of that share. That will hopefully drive more people into the industry. But that's a massively long, you know, term solution to the problem.
Yeah, we can get into economics, but bubbles that don't necessarily yield significant exponential increase in supply have to yield increase in price. There's nowhere else for that air to go. Totally. So it's just, it's interesting to see this case study. I want to open up to the rest of the group. Any questions from any of our listeners?
Hey, Roy, this is Juan Fraze. Just a couple of questions for Brett. Brett, on your comment about the supply side, you know, I come from the primary care business, got the same problem there to some degree. Do you see the PA, NP type of role developing in the vet business? And then secondly, it strikes me that your business model, sort of a fixed cost operation, you talked about the insurance and I get it, but have you considered kind of a prepaid model that's not exactly insurance that brings in some level of fixed income to mitigate that? I imagine, you know, there's spikes and valleys and in your volumes, depending on what happens in the business.
Yeah, both two excellent questions. So the first one, the industry there is no mid-level provider in the industry today. The AVMA, which is sort of our equivalent of the AMA, actively opposes the concept, interestingly. There's a lot of discussion, though, internally. We just had our big conference for the industry called VMX down in Orlando in January. And a part of that is they kind of jostle for political position inside the, you know, who's running for chair of the AVMA. And a couple of the folks are actually running on a platform of changing that stance and saying we should have a mid-level provider as an option because of this supply issue. Internally in Veg too, where we're pretty forward-looking, I like to think we are piloting the concept as a super high-level nurse, but by regulation they can't. You know, the one thing that they're not a doctor, so they can't diagnose, they can't, I forget what the five things are, but it's like diagnose, prognosis, prescription. Anyway, you guys are no better than me. There's some things that they just can't do. So the doctor has to come back and check on them. And so for our business where everything's kind of like helter skelter because it's emergency, it's not the most efficient thing in the world, but I can see people piloting the concept. And I think that you're gonna see people start to try to do so. In terms of subscription or whatever, at Veg, we've talked about it. We have not implemented anything because we haven't had to, candidly. It's continuing to be something that's simmering in the background for us, given the emergency nature of it, given the fact that any subscription would only be for us. It's kind of like, why wouldn't I as a consumer just, if I'm really going to do that, why wouldn't I just get an insurance product? But Veg is unique. So you do have some folks, Modern Animal and Small Door being the two most prominent of the rise of these new generation of general practice clinics with they're branded, they're very high end, they're very much appealing to the Dinkwad crowd. They offer, and they don't offer, it's required to be a member of their service. And so you pay $100 a month or whatever, and you have unlimited access to the vets on call, and there's a host of things, right? You still pay for all the regular stuff, but the actual visit fees or comp and all that kind of thing. So you do have some folks who are trying this out. and to varying degrees of success. I think it's hard to implement, and I don't know that anyone's got a great, it kind of feels like the primary care world, right? Where like being a member of one of the higher end subscription style clinics, like I was for a while, and then I stopped because I was like, I just, you know, I'm a reasonably healthy guy. Like it, you know, the value add was sort of de minimis. I worry that that's kind of how things are shaking out for them. I know the modern guys very well. I don't know the small door guys as well. But I know that there's mixed levels of success. And that's with the backdrop of like unlimited demand for service, right? So it's tricky. And I think you'll see more people try to test it out. But there's no, I don't think that we've cracked the code on that one yet.
Similarly, if the size of the market grows by 10% every year, you'd think that it would attract new investment and new ideas on the payer side, if it isn't already.
Yeah, that is kind of fascinating. So you've got Nationwide, you've got Trupanion. Trupanion is a standalone independent public company and does not trade well because they have not been able to get adoption rates up. Penetration rates are flat. You always hear this thing of like in Scandinavia, pet insurance rates are like 50% or something. And here there are 2%. And so what's the deal? Why is the disconnect? I've not heard a coherent answer to that question. But that seems to be the whole investment thesis, the long thesis for Trupanion.
I know the answer.
What is it?
The product here is dreadful. Couldn't be any worse. So they're selling lemons. They're selling the illusion of insurance, but it's just paper thin. Mark Maloney, you had a question?
Yes, I do. Great presentation, Brett. Have you seen anything in the world of pet elder care or pet hospice? I think as a baby boomer, I think I'm the grandparents to some of the Dinkwads.
Another excellent question. So there are, I wouldn't call it hospice, but the end of life, in my opinion, that's where this industry differs just really fundamentally in health in terms of actual care provision, right? Because you're making like an economic decision on end of life. Does it no longer make sense? Are they actually, is quality of life so bad for this animal now that it's better for them to just, for us to euthanize, right? And do it sort of humanely rather than you spend infinite dollars to the very end of the last day, right? It's fundamentally very different from human healthcare in that way. There are some really good businesses that are doing in-home euthanasia. A company called Lap of Love is kind of the best one, I think. And they will do essentially end-of-life care at home with you. It makes it a much more palatable experience than I'm sure a lot of folks on the phone have had the thing where like you wake up and the dog's just very, very sick and 10% of cases that come into veg are euthanized, right? By nature of them being emergencies. That's a kind of a shitty end to, you know, what is such an important part of, especially like your kids' lives and stuff for a decade. There's a lot of folks now who are trying to get and do what Lap of Love does. I think Lap of Love does it particularly well. But that's kind of, there's no like true hospice or anything like that. But you've got a lot of dogs who I think will be euthanized at home who have, say, cancer, right? And oncology for pets is extremely expensive and the outcomes are just as bad as in human healthcare. So it's probably a better answer for the pet. And so you see a lot of that.
Thanks.
Any questions from the group? Ben, who are the operators in the space who you admire the most, who you think are occupying their rightful space as consolidators and leaders, setting an example to others and should be around for decades to come, ensuring that there's sort of a high quality standard that's maintained across the industry?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the best consolidator is SVP, Southern Vet Partners. They consistently have the lowest level of price increases, and they like hammer that point home, have a level of consistency of operations across their sites that others don't, but they're, even though they're largely acquisition based, and they've had the most success from what I can tell from a third party's perspective on their de novo strategy, taking existing strong associate doctors, giving them an opportunity to buy a clinic rather than trying to do it sort of externally. So they're willing to sacrifice some of a given clinic to ensure professional progression and personal progression of some of their team members. So I think they treat their people right. I think that business will continue on as an independent business. I think everybody else is okay. I mean, NVA is very impressive. Some of these are very, very impressive businesses. I think NVA is run by guys like me, a bunch of private equity guys. And so because of that, it's a really well-run business. And it'll certainly persist. Nobody could buy them. They're way too big now. Are they like, you know, I don't mind competing with NVA. I don't mind competing with VCA, which is Mars's big GP platform. I prefer not to compete with SVP. Everybody else is kind of the same, in my opinion. I don't love competing with the modern small doors bond vets of the world because they're more creative than those other folks, to the detriment, I think, of our ability to recruit and retain talent, which is the big trick. I think we're kind of see what happens with a lot of those folks. So Bond was just bought by Warburg. It seems like they've changed. I've actually interviewed a couple folks who have had offers offered to them for corporate roles and then rescinded, which, you know, is obviously a very questionable practice and leads me to believe that there's some weirdness going on internally in the business. I think you'll see the shakeout of those kinds of concepts during this demand moderation phase of the business. And we'll see who's sort of real and who's naked. I think you're going to see, so Encore Vet is a good example of a business that just massively overextended themselves. So they own a very choice asset in the DC area called Friendship. They bought it for $93 million, it's my understanding. They're probably going to sell it for 70, and they're fire selling it because they're levered at 12 times. And so you've just got businesses that are very poorly run, that when the tide goes out, they're very clearly swimming naked. So I think you're going to have some of those kinds of shakeouts. So yeah, I think you've got, I'm not super candidly impressed with the quality of the teams across the industry, which is another part of the reason why it's a great space to play in, is the sophistication and the quality of the teams has not matched the level of investment and business quality, in my opinion. That's changing, but it's the last 10 years has seen a lot of people without a ton of skill be very, very successful. And so I think you're finally now seeing the kind of that. So
the Southern Group is owned by who?
Shore Capital.
Oh, sure. That's great.
They also own MVP. I think it's Mission Veterinary Partners.
Yeah, they own two different assets. Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a bit of a strange dynamic.
And so the Southern Group does well because leadership there is more conservative, probably growing at a slower pace as a result, less acquisitions, or have grown over the last few years at a slower pace?
I think it's the focus geographically. So Jay Price is the, by the way, I don't have any like real direct info from the business or anything. So this is all me just being inside the industry. But Jay Price is the CEO, founder. He's a DVN. He's a veterinarian. That's a big deal in this industry. Whenever you hear him speak, he really understands his business very well. He understands the drivers of the business. And I think he has a real pulse on his providers, which is extremely rare. I think that they have had a specific geographic focus, which you might imagine from the name. I believe they're based in... So the vet, the industry, interestingly, the vet schools are largely land grant institutions. So like like all the SEC schools have vet schools, for instance, right? It's like a very interesting dynamic. So you have a very big concentration actually outside of the traditional population density power alleys. And SVP, I think, has had a lot of success being in those areas, actually, where it would not be on your top 20 MSAs or something. Like VEG would not go there. They're not early on in our pipeline, but they've been able to play there, be very stable, not have a ton of competition, actually be able to staff their clinics because there are folks who have like, hey, I actually really like Birmingham. Like, you know, there are two vet schools in Alabama, right? You know, at Auburn and in Alabama. Mm-hmm. So you've got this kind of weird supply demand dynamic of the actual DVMs and their distribution across the country is not ideal. And so he says, you know, at a conference a little while ago, he was saying that they've got that dynamic versus, you know, California, the population to DVM graduation ratio is like massively out of whack relative mm-hmm. to some of these other states. So I think they've had a lot of success just knowing where to operate and mm-hmm. doing so well and conservatively.
And you said something about a de novo acquisition formula that's unique to this Southern group as well. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so this is another one where it's all very new, but they set out to do de novos for the first time, I think, ever. And, you know, did so, they dipped their toe into the concept. I think they opened four in 2022. What they're doing, at least again, from a third party's perspective, having talked to sort of my counterpart over there, briefly, is to take strong associates and, seed them as, you know, their own, for their own clinic, essentially, rather than either just operating them until those folks left, or looking for, having it be an actual net gain of a DVM by attracting a third party and saying, hey, we'll, you know, come develop a hospital with us. They're again, willing to sort of do the conservative thing of taking a DVM from like a four DVM practice, seating them in their own space and giving them autonomy, in order to increase retention of those kinds of folks.
Interesting. So they're creating practice leadership opportunities as a career progression
option. Correct.
And incentive for their associates. That's interesting. Okay.
Brad, yeah. I was wondering if any of these companies are pursuing opportunities internationally, and if you see that in the vet space that there is a credible pathway to international businesses.
Yeah, really good question. So a little bit is what I'll say. Right, this, again, the regulatory framework is totally different here than in human. So expanding internationally isn't as fundamentally different, I think, as it can be in some of the on the provider side. You don't see a ton of it. You do see some of it. I think we're actually going to see the opposite happen first, which is that IVC Evidencia, which is the big European, sort of the Mars of Europe. They just took an investment from Silver Lake that valued the business at like $13 billion. They're a massive vertically integrated provider over there. They bought, was it Pet Partners? All the names as always blend together. They actually bought a Canadian platform as their first North American toehold. And I expect them to expand into the US here in the relatively near future. We're all kind of waiting with bated breath to see who they buy. My money's on PetVet, but just a guess. So I think you're gonna see that. I think it seems like Mars has basically stopped growing in the US entirely. I think they're afraid of the FTC. With good reason. And so I think you're starting to see them expand into Europe and the UK. But there's not a ton of it. I think the opportunity in the US remains strong. And so certainly none of the smaller providers or consolidation groups have that, at least from what I've seen in any of the materials that I've ever read, as an actual stool of growth. I'm kind of waiting to see when they file S1s for those two businesses, for Thrive and for NVA, as to what focus that is. Because certainly NBA is pretty saturated, and they just acquired Sage and Ethos in the back half of 2021, both of which were challenged by the FTC, and they required divestitures. So they're kind of at their limit for even, those were like 20 practice groups. And so I think they're kind of at their limit of real expansion, inside, you know, domestically, which is going to be a part of the problem, I think, with the listing. So I don't know, we'll see, but nothing, it's not a huge area of growth, but it is something that's doable. Like we've considered going to Toronto, for instance, because you've got 6 vet schools in Canada and there's what, 1/10 the population in Canada versus the US. So the population to DVM ratio is actually pretty high or low. The DVM to population ratio is pretty high in Canada versus the US. So it's not the worst place to try to go build a business.
Okay, if there are no more questions, I wanted to thank you, Brett, for your time. It was incredibly educational. There's so much rich knowledge that you have in the industry and also the experience you've had in others. Being able to compare and contrast, it's really a wonderful gift for us to spend this morning with you. So just very grateful. Thank you.
Yeah, I always love talking about the industry, and I think it's a fascinating space. I've really fallen in love with the industry. Happy to do it. If there's any other questions or anything, feel free to reach out. It's bholloway@veg.vet or veg.com. And I'm always kind of around.
Thank you. Thank you, my friend. Take care.
Cheers.